All right, good morning, everyone. I don't want to put us behind schedule, so let's go ahead and get started with this morning's session, Folkways. And a couple of quick announcements. If you're just coming in, there are some handouts on the chair by the door, so please do pick one of those up. Brenda would also like me to remind everyone that the silent auction is closing after the coffee break. So everything shuts down at 11:15, a little bit earlier than usual. So if you got bids to put in, make sure that you get those done. I also need to make another announcement, and that's that unfortunately our first speaker on the schedule, Uncle Dave Lewis, who was going to present on Myth, Mass Media, and the Anglo-American Cowboy Ballad, was unable to make it to the conference. So we'll be able to hear a little bit more from our other two speakers. That's the good news. So let me introduce our first presenter today. Joe Weed is a producer, composer, filmmaker, and musician. He's released 6 albums of his own, produced many projects for independent labels and artists, and does soundtracks for film, TV, and museums. And you've probably heard his work if you've ever seen a Ken Burns documentary, but has also done music for the Lincoln Museum, the National Steinbeck Center, and other PBS documentaries. And he's recently completed the Waltz to Westphalia. Did anybody catch that on Thursday night? Okay, if not, we'll be seeing a little bit of that today as well, a documentary about the multicultural genesis of an American fiddle tune. So without any further ado, I give you Joe Weed and the Blue Bonnet Music Company and the making of an American memory, the Westphalia Waltz.
Thank you, Roberta. So, what is ado? I've always wondered about that. Without further ado, does anybody?
Is
there
much ado
about? Yeah, much ado about nothing. Yeah. So when I was talking a little bit with Tim earlier in the year about what to bring here, I thought, or we kind of thought, because this is ARSC. And there's a lot of radio people and old record company people. Maybe I could bring a slant my presentation a bit more towards the record company that was involved in the first stages of the story that I did this DVD about. I want to give you a little bit of overview of the story that my DVD, the movie, is about. And I'm going to give you play a couple of chapters. The very first chapter, which explains this old record company that was a popular sort of homemade record company in Texas, like many other small record companies after World War II. It only lasted maybe 5 years, but it unwittingly played a very important part in the development of this tune, the Westphalia Waltz, which the movie's about. And I think this is probably the only movie I've ever worked on, and maybe the only movie I've ever seen where the soundtrack is just one song. You'll probably hear 20 or 25, maybe 30 different iterations of the Westphalia Waltz before you leave the room. Actually, we're not going to see the whole movie, so maybe it'll only be 15. And all I can do is say, just don't drink any more coffee after lunch. You'll sleep fine tonight, and it'll go away by tomorrow. So the quick overview is I'm a violin player, a fiddle player, and as part of the tradition of fiddle players, when we learned tunes, we remember who taught it to us and then pass that information along to the next person we show it to. And then as part of my work as a filmmaker and record producer, I began taking a increasingly more serious role in the history of American traditional musics, especially fiddling and string band music. And I did quite an involved project on Stephen Foster and joined the Society for American Music, which is how I met Tim quite a few years ago, and eventually came to Sam. We shared a conference, the Society for American Music shared a conference with Sam, which, if there's anybody here on the board of ARSC, I want to mention to you that that was a really effective thing for me. I mean, it brought ARSC to my attention, and I think this idea of sharing conferences with other organizations, other intellectual or academic or trade interest groups, is a great idea, and it certainly worked for me. So I began researching somewhat seriously the histories of some of the American fiddle tunes that I've learned and still play today. And when I did a little bit of just a few days' work on the Westphalia waltz, I learned early on that the Westphalia waltz, which is a very common fiddle waltz, most American fiddlers know it and play it. It was copyrighted in 1946 by a fiddle player from Waco named Cotton Collins. And I said to myself, you know, if this tune was copyrighted in 1946, it doesn't mean it was written then, but it means some of the story happened then. And since it came from Texas, I can go down there and nose around, poke around. And this might be a 20th century story. And if it's a 20th century story, there might be people involved in that story who are still alive and wanting to talk about the story, or their children or their grandchildren wanting to show me pictures of grandpa or grandma. And so guess what happened? It is a 20th century story. There were those first primary sources still around, and I was fortunate enough to meet with quite a number of them, interview them, get them on tape, get them on camera. So story goes like this. Westphalia waltz. Well, first of all, let me prepare you for the legions of incorrect stories that are all over the internet. Many people like to insert themselves into the history that they tell, and this is no exception. So we have to go back to the late 19th century, early 20th century. There's a Polish wedding song. All the bands play it at weddings. It's very, it's a ribald, it's the kind of a thing you probably wouldn't sing at church. But it was very popular, and the Polish Americans would always play it at these huge Polish weddings. Sorry about the P's on this thing. The words go like this. There was a young bride who asked a famous doctor, "Oh, doctor, stop me, Roberta, if this gets too weird." Okay, I mean, you know, you had to, you censored yourself yesterday. So. "Oh, doctor, dear doctor, is it better to give in the evening or in the morning?" And the doctor says, "Well, my dear young bride, 'tis best to give at night for a good night's sleep, and then repeat in the morning to remember all day." So then there's a chorus with some nonsense syllables and stuff. So that's the song, this Polish wedding song, Pitała się Pani, known by a wide variety of titles, kind of like, you know, Suwannee River. The actual title of Suwannee River is The Old Folks at Home. We have lots of songs in our tradition that have multiple titles as well, as does this Polish song. So Polish-American immigrants in the Chicago area, in the New England, working in the mills, in the coal mines in the Alleghenies, all these places, they were playing and loving this song and sharing it and singing it. So when Victor came out with these various ethnic 78s, they brought a Polish band from Western Massachusetts back to New York and recorded them playing Pitała się Pani, this song. Columbia did the same thing a few years later. On my website, I have, and on a handout, I have lots of information about dates and all that if you're interested. I did have a handout, which, did you all get a copy? It's more based on what we'll get to after these chapters. I guess they're in the back of the room there. So there's a song, it's Polish, it's established in the United States, it gets recorded by the two largest American recording companies in 1930 and again in 1937. America's biggest Polish publisher in Chicago, Sajewski, looks like Sajewski, it's actually pronounced Sajewski, they release it in sheet music form. The biggest Polish music publisher east of Illinois, in Philadelphia, Podgorski, Ignacy Podgorski, publishes the sheet music and releases the record on Columbia. So that this song is everywhere in the culture, and it's been recorded, they're playing it on the radio. Okay, so, but I've never heard of that. I don't speak Polish. I don't sing Polish songs. It's not part of my heritage. So I was never aware of that. So the very first Polish settlement in the United States turns out to have been in Texas, in Panta Maria, in the middle of the 19th century. And the people that came over eventually ended up taking sharecropper jobs from recently freed slaves. So that group of Poles didn't become a wealthy and integrated group of people like Polish immigrants would later do up in New England and in Chicago and in Wisconsin. They remained essentially rural and poor and on farms. So in the 1930s, during the Depression, many of those farms, of course, failed. Many of those Poles headed up to Chicago, straight up Highway 35 to Chicago for work. Well, the biggest collection of Poles in Texas was a little town called Bremond, and I'm going to put a map up. Maybe I should just do that right now. And if you look at, I don't know if you can, how well you can see that, I just did this a few days ago. That's a Google map of Texas. If I had, can you follow my cursor as I move it? Okay, up here is Dallas. Okay, down where these three dots are, these are the crucial part of the state where this stuff happens. The lower right-hand dot is the little town of Bremond. The upper left-hand, up one on the left, is Waco. So we're about an hour and a half south of Dallas, okay? Bremond, which is the largest Polish settlement in Texas, is about 40 miles from Waco. Okay, there's a hillbilly band in Waco in the 1930s and again right after the war called the Lone Star Playboys. They are the most popular band in the area. They have a daily radio show on radio station WACO in Waco at lunchtime. They share the show with a young guitar player who wants to grow up and be Gene Autry. His name is Hank Thompson, and he was boyhood friends with the fiddle player in the Lone Star Playboys. So remember those facts. The Lone Star Playboys are playing at a little German settlement. All over this part of Texas, there's Czech towns, German towns, Polish towns. So this hillbilly band is playing all over at these towns. There's a little town south of Waco, 35 miles, called Westphalia. Okay, that's the bottom left of these three of these three dark stains on the map. So they become essentially the house band for Westphalia. They're playing at all the events there, all the weddings, all the parties. You'll learn about that in the movie. And then they are 32 miles from the largest collection of Poles in Texas. Turns out that this band starts doing battle dances with the sort of alpha Polish band from Bremond. The fiddle player, Cotton Collins, hears this tune because the Poles are playing it. The fiddle player in that band brought it down from Chicago in the 1930s, and it was all the rage. So the American fiddle player hears it. Cotton Collins is a Texas fiddle player, dyed in the wool. His father made fiddles. All the boys in the family and many of the girls played music. They had a family band. He's an American fiddle player. He's a Texas fiddle player. He takes this Polish melody, hears it, and plays it Texas style, and he names it for the local town of Westphalia, and thus is born the Westphalia Waltz. When people ask him about it later, it becomes his tune. He wrote it. If you ask, talk to the family today, Daddy wrote that song. His brother thinks he wrote it. What the record company promotion said was he'd picked it up in Germany during the war. I think they were distracted by the word Westphalia. He didn't go to Germany in the war. He spent his war years in France and in Vienna. So that's sort of the overview. Oh, excuse me, one important thing. 5 years later, his friend, or 8 years later, his friend Hank Thompson releases it when he's at the height of his career on Capitol Records. Merle Travis is on the session. The thing is produced by Ken Nelson. It's a very nice, very good session, very well produced. And Capitol, of course, has all the money in the world for promotion and distribution. So that's what gets it out to all the fiddlers in the United States. It's named the Westphalia Waltz. It's being played by Hank Thompson at the height of his career. The guitar player is Merle Travis. So that's sort of the overview of this thing. So I want to show you the very first chapter of my movie, which is a bit of an overview, and it really centers on the record company and how the tune came to be the Westphalia Waltz. So, without any further hemming and hawing, let's see if we can do this. ¶¶ This is about 5.5 minutes long, so this won't be long. The Waltz to Westphalia is the story of a tune becoming American. It's a 20th century story. It's a story about Texas, about Polish immigrants. It's about a recording by a small-time record company. It's about the explosive growth in country music after World War II. And it all came together in the mind of a honky-tonk fiddler who heard a pretty tune and transformed it into a piece that became part of country music history. Garland DeLamar was at the session in 1946 when Cotton Collins first recorded the Westphalia Waltz.
I came home from the service in 1944 and went to work for my wife's uncle, E.J. Shelby. Music company. We had jukeboxes and all that stuff. Of course, more than we got now. And I was going to Dallas, and Herb Rippa, that's R-I-P-P-A, owned a retail record shop on the corner of Ross and Hall in Dallas.
My dad, Herb Rippa, who was commonly called Rip to all of his friends and all of his customers, moved from Florida and 1935-36 time period to the Dallas area. He started a jukebox company called Blue Bonnet Music Company. They were in the business of putting jukeboxes into honky-tonks as well as slot machines at that time. And the honky-tonks that did the best were those that were run by black people and those that were hillbilly people.
And then Herb decided it wasn't no use to find buy records when he could make his own, so he come up with the name Blue Bonnet Records.
In the mid-40s, he decided that after his contacts with a lot of different singers, artists, and he knew what the public wanted, he decided that he would start a music label. He met a man who had been in the jukebox business also, before starting Modern Records, named Jules Beharry. And Jules had three other brothers, and they started Modern Records.
Did everybody get a chance to meet or listen to Jules Beharry yesterday? Okay. He remembers Herb, and this I gave him a couple of copies of this photograph. Is this being chopped off on the left? Let me see if I move that. This is his brother Jules, so now he has a new picture of his brother.
But his roots were with the jukebox business. My dad would record the music in the Dallas area, whether it be Dallas, Waco, Houston, or wherever. He would find the artist, they would go to a studio, he would record it, make a master, then he would ship that master to California, to the Beharry brothers, and they would cut the records and then would use their distribution network to distribute the music around the United States. And my dad would make a profit off of each record sold, not too much different from what that they do nowadays. And that business probably lasted 5 years.
And we got pretty good buddies going, and there was a hillbilly band here in Waco called Lone Star Playboys. At the original time, there was three brothers, the Booker brothers, and there were two brothers, the Incardona brothers, Sam Incardona and Vince, the banjo picker. And so we wanted to record them. They had a number that was going quite well for them around here called the Banjo Boogie, and Cotton was doing this Westphalia Waltz thing. It was real one of the most requested numbers. And Cotton had just come back from the service at this time. The recording studio where we recorded on the Blue Bonnet label, the one, the master was made on the fourth floor of the Amoco building at radio station WACO in Waco. And just like I say, the console had this few, and we was doing this recording and it was playing back and it kept getting this noise. And finally somebody looked around, the windows were open, no air conditioning, and said, turn off the fan. We did, and then we got a take. And that's the one that Herb used on the Blue Bonnet. Herb sent the masters to California and everything, so he had them made out there and brought them back, and we sold the hell out of it. It's quite simple. The record is still popular. I think the original batch was 2,500. And after that, as he reordered 500, 750, what. And then what really kicked it off, Cliffy Stone, who was recording on Capitol, and he got into the folk dance business for the schools. Those records are still selling, by the way. They're still using. And the Westphalia Waltz was picked up. So when that happened, the other bands started playing it. And then the next thing you know, everybody's, all the country artists, Tommy Jackson, all those fiddle players out of Nashville, and when they'd make an album, that would be included in it. And that's what made the Westphalia Waltz go.
In the late 1930s and 40s, the Lone Star Playboys were a popular band at dances and weddings in tiny Westphalia, just 35 miles from their home in Waco. Cotton Collins said he named the tune for the town of Westphalia, but as the piece became popular and was played throughout the U.S., many assumed it was named for Westphalia, Germany, far better known than a tiny hamlet in Texas. In Westphalia, Texas, people still remember Cotton Collins, the Lone Star Playboys, and the venues where they performed.
I was born there and...
Okay, now I think rather than just showing the movie, I want to just go to a few selected spots to kind of concentrate on this record company theme. So Herb Ripa, I'm going to keep the movie going here and I'm going to go to another channel. Stop. Thank you for a little overview still to keep us on this theme of the record company. Herb Ripa was a jukeboxer. He was a jobber. He had a route of about 100 jukeboxes. The fellow that we just listened to, whose face is there in the upper left-hand corner, Garland DeLamar, just died last year. But Garland was a jukebox operator. He worked for his wife's uncle, E.J. Shelby. And I found a letter from Garland in 1958, I think it was, issue of Billboard magazine, which he was essentially saying there was a movement underfoot to raise the price of jukeboxes from a nickel to a dime. And people that serviced jukeboxes in small rural areas were very opposed to that because people could spend a nickel and people couldn't spend a dime. And so he wrote a letter to the editor sort of essentially saying that. The other guy I'm going to get to after we do the movie, Sergeant Fitch, was a jukebox operator. Many Texas small record companies came from the Beharies. They were jukebox operators. And a lot of these guys were motivated to make record companies because they could get the records cheaper than they could from their distributors, from the record companies, and they could get records that would answer the needs they saw in their local communities that the record companies weren't answering. So this other little chapter called Boom Time will help give a little more context about what happened right after the war when these companies were formed. Let's see here. Cotton's Westphalia Waltz sold well in a region where for generations people have been listening to German, Czech, Bohemian, and Polish music. Within a year of the Lone Star Playboys release, Floyd Tillman and Cliffy Stone also recorded it.
In 1955, Hank Thompson was at the top of the country music charts. His well-produced version on Capitol Records brought the Westphalia Waltz to a national audience.
Country music boomed after World War II. It began to show evidence of expansion just as soon as the war was over there in the mid, late 1940s, but the real boom came in the early 50s with Hank Williams riding the crest of that post-war wave. And the music boomed is because the economy was resurgent from the war. Scarcity was becoming a thing of the past. Musicians could tour more readily because they could get tires for their automobiles and gas for their travels. The record companies could make more records because shellac was no longer being rationed. And so the number of records released each year expanded largely from both big companies like Columbia and Victor, but also a lot of small labels like Imperial and Gold Star and Abbott and all kinds of labels that appeared in the 1940s, early 50s. There were just more jobs for country musicians. Jukeboxes were playing the records, dance halls were competing with each other for live talent. And so a person who decided to go into country music in these years could find a much bigger audience with more money in his pockets than it had ever been possible in the past. And so a song like Westphalia Waltz was bound to attract a greater audience because there was this pent-up demand of the war was being satisfied by the resurgence of activity in entertainment as a whole. Once the song was introduced and began to show its popularity, then people like Floyd Tillman and Hank Thompson would record the song as they were recording other tunes like that and introducing it to an even larger audience than it had.
Westphalia is only 37 miles from Bremen, the largest Polish settlement in Texas in the first half of the 20th century. During the Great Depression, many of the Bremen farms failed, and the Polish Texans went to Chicago for work. One of them was Steve Okoinski, the best fiddler in Bremen. Okoinski played with Polish musicians in Chicago and brought their music back to Bremen, including a tune called Pitawa Szepani. Today, Polish Texan Brian Marshall remembers Okoinski's version.
Okay, and at this point, we learn about, from Brian, the culture of the Poles there in Bremen, Texas. I want to run up ahead and play a little bit of this chapter about New England, because this is the band that recorded the Polish song for Victor. And then I think when I've done that, I'll come back and talk a little bit about these other record companies. I want to be careful with the time. I'm not quite... 15? Okay. Does that include time for the smart people to talk? Okay, good. Okay, then here is... When Joe Smiel was a child playing the accordion in Pennsylvania, a Polish immigrant named Stanley Kapinos was playing the trumpet in Massachusetts. In 1912, his family had settled in Ludlow, a mill town that attracted many Polish immigrants. Stanley played lead trumpet in 1930 when the Robach Franz Orchestra recorded Pitawa Szepani for Victor, America's largest record company.
Stanley was my grandfather. It was my mom's father, and my mom was an only child, so Stanley and his wife Mary, and my mom, my dad, my two brothers and I, it was a very close-knit family. We spent a lot of time here at the funeral home where Stanley and Mary lived. Stanley was born in Poland on August of 1900, and in 1912 he came to this country. He came through Ellis Island. And Stanley had talked about life in Poland and about having to share things like shoes and winter coats. You wore shoes only in the winter when it was bitter cold because you couldn't afford another pair if you wore them out. Poland was extremely poor. They were a farming family from a small community. He actually was introduced to music here in the States. and was encouraged by locals to stick with music and that it would help him. And it did. Stanley was extremely successful. His career with the band and as a musician flourished, and his brother-in-law convinced him to go to mortuary school, which he did. He would talk about playing either a dance job or playing during the week at one of the movie theaters. And if he came home, rounded the corner, and saw the post light on, he knew there was work at the funeral home waiting for him. They played countless weddings. Ludlow, Wilbraham, Indian Orchard, Chicopee, Holyoke, Springfield. And Polish weddings at the time were all-day affairs, well into the night. The funeral home had always had a limousine, and you had a good-sized band that you needed to get to one place. The limousine was the mode of transportation. It was used at the funeral home, obviously, for funeral services, and as the pictures show, it was used as transportation for the band. The bass tied to the roof, the other musical instruments covered in their canvas carrying cases for transportation, strapped down to the trunk of the vehicle. I can remember my grandfather talking about it was his car. He was more or less the manager of the band, and Stanley talking about his need to make sure they got home safely and would not drink when they were playing. And he would be the designated driver, for lack of better words, no matter how tired he was. And he would also talk about coming home from some of the band's jobs that they had during the winter months, and how there were times when he had to keep a cigarette lit because the cigarette was helping to keep the frost off the inside of the windshield. The band used to do a number of live performances over the years. There were a lot of old radio shows. WMAS radio station in Springfield, still in existence today. In that day and age, the radio was the big form of entertainment, and from various clubs, dance halls, they would broadcast live from time to time. I can remember Stanley talking about there being one particular bar in Holyoke where it was almost embarrassing listening to some of the things that were being done, because if the band didn't do it right, they stopped and started over again. But it was very folksy, and it was entertainment. They would also play at the various theme dances, the balloon dance, the poster, harvest dances. There were a number of records that the various bands cut, and sadly, I believe we have only two of the 78s from the band. The records were meant to be sold to those who could afford, and you didn't keep them because, you know, the 99 cent or a dollar and a half record was big money. You depended on the social clubs, the different Polish clubs in the various communities for entertainment. My godmother and her sister lived next door to the Kosciuszko Hall on Rapla Street in Indian Orchard. They used to hear Roebuck and Frantz from their apartment. They would sit on the porch and listen to the band. At that time, Polish people stayed amongst themselves. There was a comfort being with your own. You could understand the language, and you had people that came over from Poland who spoke Polish only and were very comfortable in their own community of people who had the same customs and traditions.
I think I'll pause it at that point and talk a little bit about, let's go back to Texas, since I mentioned earlier we talked about these little record companies. I just mentioned four, before showing these last two chapters, I mentioned four companies that had gone from being jukebox jobbers, individuals many times, like the Beharry Brothers, like Garland DeLamar, our narrator earlier, like Herb Ripa, who founded this company, the Bluebonnet Record Company, Bluebonnet Music Company, and Charlie Fitch, who founded Sarge Record Company. Sarge was his nickname. I have a little handout. If I can get this computer to cooperate, I can give you a little explanation on this big screen here that helps to sort of compare and contrast these two guys. Keep in mind what Bill Malone said, though, that right after World War II, there was sort of a pent-up demand. I mean, people had money, finally, after all those years of the Depression and then being without during the war. They wanted to spend it on recreation. They wanted to spend it on entertainment. People could buy tires for their cars again. They could buy gas and tour. Sure, the major tours of the big bands were a thing of the past. They could never recover. But, you know, a five-piece band, a four-piece band that fits in one car could certainly do that. People could buy those records. So let's see here. What do we have on the screen? That's the first one. This is a blow-up from the last map that was up there. That was all of Texas. This is, in the upper left-hand corner, the green dot is Waco. Go down south to the town of Westphalia, for which Cotton named the song. And over to the right, the green dot, is Bremond, the largest Polish settlement in the state of Texas. And so it's like a 35-mile triangle. So all that action happened right in a small, probably 40-mile radius. A radius would be like less than 20-mile radius. And in spite of what they all claim, Cotton Collins did not learn that in Germany and did not write it. The Poles in Bremond were playing it. Okay, so here we have Herb Ripa on the left and Charlie Fitch on the right. Charlie's from Luling, Texas, and Luling is east of Austin, probably less than an hour. It's just off of Highway 10, which connects, is it San Antonio and Houston? Any Texans in here? Yeah, it goes through Houston. Does it go to San Antonio? Yeah, so Luling is I think, just north of that freeway. So it's maybe equidistant from San Antonio and Austin. About an hour's drive, you know, less than an hour if the traffic's good. Herb Ripa, of course, was in Waco, as we just learned. And both of these fellas, their preparation for being a, quote, record company, unquote. Herb's pre-war business was with slot machines, which were not outlawed in Texas until, I think it was the very late 1930s. Later on, after that was gone, he also operated pinball machines. He was a jobber. He would do his rounds to the bars and the honky-tonks that had his gear in there and supply them with records. Charlie Fitch, in World War II, he trained in electronics. He was on a bomber. He was the electrician on the plane. He ran a repair shop. He took his training in electronics that he got from the Army and opened up a little television and radio repair shop in Luling. He had about 25 jukeboxes, whereas Herb Ripa had about 100. And of course, these guys, from servicing those jukeboxes, they learned what was going to sell in their little, in their local areas. One thing that's not on the handout, I want to mention, they, in both cases, these guys recorded lots and lots of hillbilly music, also blues. And Herb Ripa had a black man working for him in Waco. And the biggest part of his business was black music, race records, and gospel music. And Charlie Fitch in Luling opened up a second label called Sargento, or Sargento, Spanish for sergeant, and sold Mexican-American and Mexican-Texan music. Both they learned what the locals wanted, of course, from stoking the jukeboxes and collecting the money that people had been paying every week. The Bluebonnet Music Company essentially lasted a little less than 5 years. And I've got quite a long, extensive interview with Herb where he talks about that, what it was like growing up in the family of a guy owning a record company, and some of the reasons for why they stopped running the company come out. Essentially, he sold everything to Joe Bahari, who was here yesterday, and his brothers, and stopped being a record company from that point forward. Charlie Fitch kept in business, had hundreds of titles. I've got a copy of one of his catalogs with me if any of you record collectors want to have a quick look at it. So the legacy of both guys. When Herb Ripa got sold off the Bluebonnet Music Company, all the artists, all the masters, all the rights, everything went to the Bahari brothers. His legacy, certainly the Westphalia Waltz, and fewer than 50 titles. He recorded Hank Thompson, of course, who later went on to great fame. If you can find a Bluebonnet recording of Hank Thompson, there are a few out there. It's worth big money, so it's not news to you guys. Grab it. And Sheb Woolley, is anybody old enough to remember, was a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater? Yeah. Okay, so that was Sheb Woolley, and he got his start with Herb Ripa and Bluebonnet Records. Okay. So let's go back down into to Luling. What was Charlie Fitch's legacy? Well, Doug Somm, of course, who just recently died. Adolf Hoffner, who had a wonderful dual career as a Czech band leader, which was very successful, of course, in Texas, and as a Western swing band leader. They sold over 160 titles. He recorded Adolf, of course, Doug Somm, and Willie Nelson. So a couple of parallels there with these guys, different levels of success. And I think I'll make room now for our next speaker. Is there any time for any questions or any comments? Plenty of time. And if I think I should let our next speaker go after we have a few questions. And then if there's time at the end of the session, I have on the computer here some video of Herb Ripa's son, Herb Ripa Jr., who lives now in San Antonio. You met him in that first chapter. And I've got about 20 minutes I culled from all my hours of interviews with him, in which he talks about the record company and growing up with that sort of reality. So questions, anybody, comments? You in the back row? Come to know. Good question. I don't know if those, and it might depend on the brand of the jukebox. That's certainly worth some investigating. In the case of Herb Ripa, he used almost exclusively Wurlitzers, and after one point he did, because it was so difficult to keep parts for all the different ones. And so the Wurlitzers, that'd be good to find out. If he could tell, certainly from the bar owners, and one of the things in his interview, he describes going and collecting the nickels from all these honky-tonks. And typically, Herb Jr., the little kid, would make stacks of the nickels, and the bar owner was right there every time with watching the whole thing. And of course, when they had the money counted, he'd give all the nickels back to the bar owner, and the bar owner would give Herb half of that money in bills. The bar owner then would have those nickels for patrons to stuff back into the jukeboxes, and the next week the whole thing would start all over again. So he saw what records were wearing, certainly which ones were wearing out. He knew which ones the bar owners, the honky-tonk owners, would ask for particular ones. And a lot of his business, Herb's business with Bluebonnet, was in the black section of Dallas. And they would ask him for particular blues artists and particular styles of music. But I don't know if the logging on those, if there was any logging on those machines. It would have been mechanically based, of course. But I don't know. That's a really good question. I wish I knew.
I'm pretty sure it was
Based on where on the records. Yes, sir. Every other day. Where was he? Where did you? In Philadelphia. Polish music, by any chance? No. Okay. Were there other questions? I see another hand. Well, let's. Why don't I make way for our next speaker? Are you going to be using the computer? Okay. Then I'll. I will. Yeah. Make a changeover. Maybe you want to kill the audio for a second too, Katie. And then if you'd like to stick around after the next presentation, I'd be happy to show some of this interview with Herb, and you can learn about life as a record company from the voice of the sun.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.